complained. "I concur," I said, helping him out of the pool bed. He bore a nasty bruise near his temple where Rishtitalan's staff had landed. I took a moment to scan him with mage sight, and then another diagnostic spell. "You might be working on a concussion," I advised. "See Lelastian about that before we move." I glanced over my shoulder, where Eratas was dealing with the last of the Draugan workers, slicing off a leg with his blade before removing his head. I think the Alka Alon are about done with the servants, anyway. "I've had worse in tavern arguments. Remember that little wine shop in Faris by the docks? And those three big Unstarans?" "They weren't necromancers," I reminded him. "We don't know just what these weapons can do yet." "Get it checked out," I ordered.
"Yes, Captain,"
Sandy said, rolling his eyes.
"Sire Rishtitalan was the sole guardian of note, it appears,"
Sire Kay observed as he climbed out of the pit.
"Only at this point,"
Eratas replied, as he wiped his blade clean.
"But we are not even at the entrance to the undercaverns yet.
There is little to guard here, so deep behind Korbar's defences. The real treasures lie below. That is where the necromancer will have his greatest strength."
"If this is an assay of their power,"
Mavone said, examining the iron staff of the Nemavort gingerly,
"then the true guardians will be formidable. This rod drank in my spells like a drunkard at a festival. I'm no enchanterman, but I think it converted that power to energize the necromantic architecture of the thing."
"That does sound efficient," Sandy said, as Lelastian tended his wound.
"Using your enemy's power to improve your defenses is clever. A petty it requires you to be dead before you can use it,"
Mavone agreed, making the staff disappear into a huckster, presumably for later study.
"That would be handy."
"This chamber is likely where Korbal plans on doing the finishing work for his new bodies," Lelastian remarked, looking around the place. "It's far from complete yet, but this is as much necromantic laboratory as it is a ceremonial chamber. That pool will probably be filled with the fluids required to animate a fresh body."
"What kind of fluids?"
Sandy asked curiously.
"You really, really don't want to know," the sorceress said grimly, as she placed a bandage on his brow over the bruise.
It stuck there without her having to bind it into place with another. "Korbal's process isn't like the simple spells your folk use to reanimate the dead. They're designed to be far more permanent and sustain the host body far beyond simple animation. It's a sophisticated technique that requires much specialized equipment and careful attention to minute detail. At least, that's his theory," she added, shaking her head. "In their quest for true immortality, the Enshadowed have yet to perfect it."
"This, then, is their opportunity,"
Onranian nodded, gravely examining the chamber.
"With the resources Anthatio provides, they can complete their ghoulish research."
"And win undying dominion over us all, eventually,"
agreed Eratas, grimly.
"Then might I suggest we not linger, lest the cleaning staff come around and discover us prematurely,"
suggested Hans. It was clear he wasn't thrilled with the way we were running this raid, but I suppose thieves are always a little nervous in larger groups.
"I agree," Ashguri nodded. "As soon as you've caught your breath, we can descend. That doorway leads to the deeper regions,"
he said authoritatively, as he pointed to the door the Draugan had appeared from. In short order, we organized ourselves and began descending the narrow stairs. It was probably my imagination, more than any spell, but every step down increased my sense of foreboding. The entire place was just creepy that way. I don't know precisely where it happened, but at some point we were decidedly underground, not merely walking through a construction site on the surface. The walls around us went from being well-laid stone blocks to being a solid wall of limestone through which a shaft had been cut. A sharp bend at the end of the stairwell became a landing that sprawled out into a much larger chamber. It was dark when we entered, but empty of guards or attendants. That didn't mean it was unoccupied. In small alcoves along arcades carved on both sides of the big chamber were bodies chained to the walls by their wrists. The restraints seemed redundant. Each of the captives was bound by necromantic enchantments that prohibited any voluntary movement. The wretched inhabitants were locked into a prison of their own minds, blankly staring ahead while being confined behind their own eyes, impotent to move their bodies. There were about a score of them, mostly human,
but a few diminutive Alkans, too. Each were stripped naked and stood as calmly as statues in their place.
"These minds are all but numbed,"
Mavone said, as he examined one woman whose calm stare belied Mavone's concern.
"Yet they are completely aware. They must be going mad in there."
"Why do this?" demanded Hans, as he stared around at the naked prisoners in disgust.
"They aren't even being tortured. What kind of prison is this?"
"This is not a prison. This is a laboratory," the Lastian informed him coolly. "These are not prisoners. They are subjects. Host bodies being prepared for habitation by a foreign enneagram. No doubt the poor things can hear everything we say, but can't do anything about it."
"Hey," Sandy said suddenly, "I know this one."
He pushed his way over to another woman, a middle-aged lady with a slight paunch and dark hair that had been wrapped in a thong to keep it out of her face without regard to the usual concerns of beauty.
"This is Andra Anakosin, an adept I trained with briefly in Phallus."
"A mage?" I asked, suddenly more interested.
"You're sure?"
"Andra and I were intimate,"
Sandy confessed without embarrassment.
"I'd remember her anywhere," he added, as he studied his old flame. "Is she's tits, this is bad. She's from southern Alshar, from the old coastlord cities. How did she get all the way up here?"
"The Enshadowed and the Nemavorti have been assailing an Ultramar for months now," Hans explained. "They have especially targeted our folk, for they require host bodies that possess Rajira for some reason. All mage kind has been afraid. Mostly, they work quietly, kidnapping and abducting mage folk from their homes and laboratories. Other times they purchase the talented outright at slave auctions on the docks. The remains of the censorate are so terrified that they have taken refuge in the Tower of Sorcery and made it into a true fortress for the first time in centuries."
"Well, that's depressing," Mavone observed.
"Talented human bodies are the only ones which can sustain an Alkan enneagram for any length of time,"
Lelastian informed us.
"Even then, the more active architecture degrades the flesh quickly, if restorative spells and preservation charms are not used."
"That's hardly a sustainable plan,"
Mavone pointed out, as he studied a broad-shouldered Gilmoran who looked enough like him to be related.
"They can't simply move from one body to another forever."
"That's an interim step," agreed Onranyan. "Korbal is a necromancer. His strength is in the transformation process. His minions, however, were working diligently on the perfect Alkan form through transgenic enchantment to construct a permanent host."
"Idiots," snorted Lelastian. "No one knows more about transgenic enchantment than I do."
"Umen does,"
Onranyan reminded her. Whoever Umen was, the revelation startled the sorceress.
"Umen? Umen is dead," she declared.
"Actually, I believe she's undead,"
corrected Onranyan gently. "She did not fall in the war. When the council issued its decree, she changed sides and enlisted with the renegades under the name Ketelen."
"Defiant.
Yes, that is like her," Lelastian conceded. "She hated it when they moved against her work, but I never would have suspected she'd joined the Enshadowed."
"It wasn't principle or fanaticism that brought her to their side," Eritas recounted. "It was anger and arrogance. She felt it was the right of her kindred to explore such researches. She was unwilling to sully the name she'd worked so hard to establish, but she bridled against the edict as unfair and irresponsible. Korbal recruited her as Ketelen, and she worked for him for a few years before his capture. She was sentenced to entombment, just as his more devout followers were."
"I doubt she accepted that gracefully," the Lastian said, shaking her head.
"She didn't have much choice," Eritas said. "She rebelled. She faced the consequences. Surely you can appreciate that, Elre."
"None better," she replied proudly to the Alkan Lord.
"But if Umen has been brought back to existence, and she's pissed off, we may have more troubles than we anticipated."
"Who is this Umen person?"
Sayake asked, frustrated by the discussion.
She's me from an earlier age," Lelastian said. "That is, she was a great master at the art of transgenics. Perhaps the greatest master before she—" "In any case," she said, collecting her thoughts, "she was brilliant.
She could design genomic expressions the way that Tal Alon can whistle.
They can whistle? I asked, surprised.
She made a face, as if I was a barbarian.
If Korbal has her in his service, I shudder to think what kind of host body she might design for him, she said, shaking her head. Especially if she's pissed off. Umen's spitefulness was legendary.
How do you think she'd react to a couple of centuries trapped in a cave? I asked.
Without Elre's graciousness, Eritas said, shaking his head. All of the Nemofoti in Korbal's court are likely to be as resentful. Many were scholars or mere ideologues, not true renegades. They may well consider their punishment severe, considering their crimes.
Well, she's got a wondrous palate with which to work, Lelastian conceded. I'm assuming that the Nemovorti, once they perfected their necromantic transfer, found humanity an ideal testing ground for all of their twisted theories. Using these as models, Umen cannot fail to indulge her whimsy in her art, unrestricted by censure or propriety.
Best we slay them before they can be so foully used, Sayake said, drawing his sword.
Hold on there, Dragonslayer,
Sandoval quickly declared, standing in front of his comatose friend.
Their minds are imprisoned, but they are not yet destroyed. They can be rescued, he insisted.
We are not situated as a rescue party, Lord Eritas observed.
Neither are we executioners, Lelastian agreed. Besides, there are better candidates for your blade nearby than these unfortunates, she said, gesturing to the humans.
Powenola, Onranyan exclaimed in his native language. We'd best not slay them. This Alkan is Radjuath, Sungmaster of the Mystic Lands. I'd take a hogshead of wine on it.
Radjuath? Eritas asked in disbelief.
Impossible.
I know him, Onranyan said with fondness. We were to meet at the Aslarath refuge on Lake Timoron before the invasion began. What in the realms of light and darkness is he doing here?
Languishing, suggested Mavone.
Why cannot this be Radjuath?
He asked Lord Eritas. The High Lord straightened his shoulders and peered at the immobilized form.
Because Radjuath, by all accounts, was at Amagine when the invasion arrived. He was never accounted among the survivors, he explained quietly. It was thought that he perished at the side of the Aronin, as they were great friends. Their houses were closely allied.
That is disturbing, I agreed. I studied the face of the Alkan and tried to affix it in my memory. Perhaps some time with a memory stone might allow me to confirm his identity. Then I realized how silly that was. He was an Alka Alon, chained in this dreadful dungeon. I didn't really need to see his pedigree to decide to rescue him.
What about this one? Asked Hans, gesturing gracefully to the other Alkan, a female.
She I do not know, confessed Onranyan, as he peered at the diminutive maid, or crone. I still have a hard time judging such things in the Alka Alon's original forms.
Well, let's wake her up and ask her, shall we? Suggested Lelastian. Indeed, let us wake them all.
Can it be done? Sayake asked, sheathing his sword, finally.
Oh, yes, Lelastian agreed, removing a few items from the bag she carried over her shoulder. It's just a light stasis, not much more than that blue magic trickery your folk are so fond of, she explained as she fiddled with her whatever they were. True, it's necromantic in function, but the basic spell architecture is the same, just significantly increased, a function of the scalability of the song spell.
You're certain? Sandoval asked, looking at his friend's stone-like face with concern.
Well, yes, Lelastian said reluctantly. I've used a variation of the song spell myself.
There was a moment of expectant silence as we all stared at her. She snorted defensively.
Don't look at me that way. Magic is amoral. Spells that can be used to kill can be used to cure. There's nothing particularly evil about this. It's just a biological stasis field. It keeps animals quiet when you're operating on them, she explained.
That made sense to me. Lord Eritas continued to look skeptical. He might not have been the only one.
Oh, don't be so judgmental. Do I look like I have an army of undead slaves hiding at the Tower of Refuge? You've been there. Don't you think the place would be a hell of a lot neater? I'm a medic, not a necromancer.
You're a rebel, Elre, Eritas pronounced, a rebel on parole in the middle of a vital mission, I reminded her, and possibly within moments of being apprehended. Can we conclude this verbal duel some other time? I proposed. I concur with our captain, good scholars, Hans said lightly. From my experience, I'd say that this door has the best likelihood of leading to the undercaverns, on account of the multitude of stairs going down on the other side. That is where the entrance would be, conceded Eratas. Damn them. They must have built this manufactory of abominations over the ruins of the Hall of Memory. That's as close to blasphemy as my people can manage, he said, a dire tone in his voice. But this door is allayed with a sign, Unranyan pointed out, waving his hand in front of it and singing a few words. A pale blue Alcan glyph appeared. What does it say? Our language indicates, with layers of inference and context, a particular meaning, Unranyan lectured. Our symbols don't merely say, they truly inform. But only those who understand those subtle contexts, those who can make the proper inferences of meaning, and all of the possible shades of that meaning. So what subtle concept does this particular glyph indicate? Asked Mavone, studying the squiggly blue line dancing in the air. To the dungeon, supplied Lilastian with a snicker. And the context, prompted Hans. Ah, this way to the dungeon? It's down these stairs? Suggested Mavone. More or less, Unranyan shrugged. Why would they put a dungeon in such close proximity to a... Oh, Sire Kay said, mentally answering his own question. They use their prisoners for hosts for their foul transformations, he guessed. Or worse, agreed Lilastian, shaking her head sadly. Korbal was a great necromancer, but his minions explored all manner of dark and forbidden sorceries, using their twisted ideologies to justify their crimes. I fear that we have yet to see the worst of what the Enshadowed have been working on. Can we please free these people? Sandoval nearly begged. I find it disconcerting to discuss mundane matters in front of them while they suffer. These are no mundane matters, Lilastian insisted. Some of the schemes the Enshadowed indulged in were worse than genocidal. How could anything be worse than genocide? Mavone asked. Please, Sandoval said, impatiently. The prisoners. Oh, fine, Lilastian sighed. Unranyan, if you would perform the Aliamathna? That old thing? I suppose it would work, he shrugged. If you gentlemen will assist with the restraints, I shall wake our sleepers from their troubled slumbers. He cleared his throat before beginning a short but elaborate tune. I don't know if he sang words or was making up nonsense, but I could feel the magic rise as his notes filled the dismal room. It took a few moments to have an effect. Time Mavone, Kay, and Sandy used to break the thin steel chains that kept the bodies anchored to the walls of their galleries. One by one, the captives shuddered as life returned to their docile limbs. Their faces slowly contorted into expressions of longing, suffering, or great relief. And one by one, they fell to the floor as control over their own bodies came back. Andra, Sandy called, as he helped his naked friend slowly to her knees. He quickly covered her with his mantle, which her fingers blindly clutched around her. Andra, it's Sandoval. Andra, can you understand me? Unranyan was taking a more Alcan approach with his comrade, scooping up his small body and cradling it like a babe while he sang what I guessed was a restorative song spell to him. Sandy? Andra asked first. She blinked her eyes, as if she were just regaining the use of them, and the ability to recognize and connect with what she was seeing. Are you another dream? Unfortunately, I am corporate and real, else I'd be far handsomer and better dressed. The sandy-haired mage grinned. Can I get you something? Water? She considered a moment, her head shaking. She took a deep breath and shuddered, exercising great will to establish control. Her voice cracked as she spoke, and her long, thin fingers grasped his leather vambrace. Her eyes opened wide, and with a terrified insistence, her gaze bore into his, like an animal's. Get me the hell's out of here, she pleaded, with such visceral need that it tore at my sympathies. What horrors she must have witnessed, what hellish torture she must have endured, I could only imagine. I have a very good imagination. I shuddered myself, and the megalith throbbed in response. "Bide," Mavone insisted, holding up a gloved hand. "My lady, I wish to rescue you nearly as much as you wish to be rescued, but we have an urgent matter at hand. We wish to know if you have intelligence on our enemy, Korbal the Necromancer, and his lackeys. It is our aim to challenge his plans, and any word you could lend to that effort would be graciously appreciated." Mavone always knows what to say. Damned Gilmorans.
"They? Dear gods, they were going to replace me, burn out my soul, and stuff one of their folk inside my body. I saw them do it to the others, dozens of others, Sandy. It was horrible. They scream in agony for hours and hours before they take. I had to watch it. I couldn't look away. I couldn't leave. I couldn't move. It's agony. It's the cruelest torture, to be stripped of your very identity, your soul, and feel it replaced with another. Pain. Unimaginable pain. And then the things they put in their bodies, Sandy. The horrible, nasty things."
"They are the necromantic remnants of a group of Alka-Alon known as the Enshadowed," I explained. "When they arise in such bodies, they are called the Nemovorti. They seek immortality and power over the realms of Alkans and men alike."
"I know the Nemovorti,"
Andra gasped, shaking her head. "The filthy walking corpses took me,
right from my shop."
"The Nemovorti are vile," she agreed, "but they are not so fearsome. Mere Alkan souls. What they put in their Alkan hosts, save a few they reserve for some other purposes. They are not Alka-Alon," she said. "They are some awful creature who, or the ones that,
dear gods,"
she said, with a shudder that shook her entire body,
"get me away from this place."
"I can speak to more," one of the bearded men said in a shaky voice. "I am Jareth of Ro, a hedge mage," he added, without fear of scorn. "When I could, I listened, just to keep from going mad. The bastards are, they're building an army."
"They have armies," Hans pointed out, helping the man over to the table in the center of the room. "They have great whopping armies, goblins, hobgoblins, Draugen.
Nay," he insisted, "they raise armies of the ancient dead, dredged from some hellish grotto in the depths of this horrid place."
"Well, that doesn't sound good," Hans pointed out. On Ranyan's low humming began to awaken the little Alkan friend, while Lelastian tended to the female. The rest of the prisoners struggled awake on their own, calming and comforting each other, assuring themselves that they were being rescued, finally.
"It's not,"
agreed Jareth, a grim expression on his fuzzy face. "We were to be used to make more of those yellow-eyed freaks," he said angrily. "We were to be pretty compared to those horrors. Then we would be sent to villages and towns to prepare them for their advance," he said, swallowing. "But the real monsters, those they had below," he said, nodding toward the door to the stairs. "That's where the worst ones were. They were making special bodies for special parasites. They've got a whole crew of them downstairs, each one worth an army, to hear them tell it. Once we, our replacements, if you take my meaning, once we were in place and had prepared the way, then they would summon those beasts to slay."
Onranyan began speaking softly to his friend, who obliged with a reply in the creakiest voice I've ever heard come out of an Alkan, little or big. It sounded like the cheapest tin bell ever made. But whatever he said got the songmaster's attention. He looked up, startled.
"Min, there's a problem," he began. "My friend here, he's telling me. Well, he says that Korbal is using the Alkan prisoners he has as hosts."
"We've established that," Mavone agreed.
"Not for the Enshadowed,"
he insisted. "They're using the Alkans for hosts, for some of the ancients from the Ghost Rock, the ancestors of the Vundle."
"This, too, is well established," Mavone nodded.
"Not for fighting," Onranyan tried to explain. "They are using them as sacrifices. The Alka-Alon system can accommodate far greater enneagrammatic capacity than a mere human," he said, without trying to be insulting. "They cannot bear the imprint from the ancient enneagrams long before their bodies start to decay, but long enough to be taken to the sacrificial stone."
"But why use them? Wouldn't a regular Alkan do?"
Mavone asked.
I thought it was a little insensitive, but then Mavone could manage that with more grace than most. Onranian relayed the question to his friend, whose colour seemed to be returning. The little fellow thought for a moment before answering back. It was a long answer. Because the necromantic energy resulting from sacrificing such monstrosities feeds both the power and the structure of the Umbric field far more than mere Alka alone, he explained, orders of magnitude more.
That would explain its recent increase, nodded Sandoval, as he rubbed Andra's shoulders.
They needn't use monsters for such purpose, Lord Eratas said, speaking for the first time. There are many fantastic creatures from Kalador's remote past, stored within the Ghost Rock. Many are peaceful and brilliantly complex.
The victims don't live very long, I'm afraid,
agreed Onranian after further discussion.
More like livestock than prisoners, I suppose.
Oh, the monsters are quite real, the Lastian said, as she broke her conversation with the younger female. This is Drathalia, a maid responsible for Alonut trees. Despite her lowly position, she has a keen mind and paid careful attention to the songs of law. She tells me that there are horrific bodies down those stairs, and the souls of the ancient damned to fill them, but they are not designed to fight Humani, nay, not even your gods, or even Alka alone. They're meant to slay the Vundle, she said, with desperate sadness.
While Lelastian's baleful words hung in the air and shivered our souls, Pentandra chose to contact me mind to mind.
Min, good news, she announced. I could use some right now. Princess Rardine and 6 other prisoners have safely arrived. His Grace and Sir Gideon and 2 knights also came through.
Yeah, that's great news,
I agreed. We've made our way to the entrance of the Undercaverns. Can you be ready to receive more prisoners?
More prisoners?
Korbal apparently keeps several collections. We found 16 humans and a couple of Alka Alon down here, and Sandy wants us to get them out.
I'll have the staff prepare a welcome, she promised.
Any problems?
1 cantankerous Nemavort and a squadron of Draugen. Apart from that, it's been quiet. How fares the battle elsewhere?
Well,
she said, after a pause, it's evolving more quickly than I anticipated, though.
Azar's group has been highly successful in setting the western end of the island on fire, she reported. The Terra Alon Brigade has broken through the southern defences, and the Kasari are spreading out to make mischief. Dara and the Sky Riders are raining down magical death and destruction from above. Telamon wants to lead a squadron in support of Tyndall and Rondal and the other Astazi Knights.
What?
Why didn't they escape with the Duke and the Princess?
They went back.
Atapol and Tyndall were engaged, and Rondal and Nothua went back to assist. They want to destroy as much of the Tower of Despair as they can, and Tyndall thinks he's discovered something.
Tyndall always thinks he's discovered something, I fumed.
That's mitigated by the fact that he has, in fact, discovered many things in the past, she reminded me. I trust his judgment. You should too.
Not if it gets him killed.
He's managed to survive so far, Pentandra insisted. I've been getting the reports from them. You haven't. That place is a massive barracks complex. Armory, storehouse, the whole works. That's why they put the special prisoners there. If we weren't certain before, now we have confirmation that Korbal is a threat to the kingdom.
Yes, that nearly escaped my attention, I shot back sarcastically.
The plan was to rescue the princess, any other high-value prisoners, and get the hells out.
The plan has changed, she said simply.
Rondal is headed back with a small team of volunteers to support Tyndall and Nothwa. They have their mission. You have yours.
My mission hasn't changed.
Really? She replied. Then why am I suddenly contending with 18 unanticipated prisoners?
Because, damn it, they have valuable intelligence on Korbal's schemes,
which is precisely what Tyndall is trying to discover, she reasoned patiently. Damn it, Min, you have to trust me to do my job, and you do yours.
My job is operational control of this mama's show. Yours is to retrieve the handmaiden.
I took a deep breath. I really hated it when Penny was right.
Fine.
Prepare to receive prisoners. I'll send as many through as I can with Mavone, Sandoval, Onranian, and Lelastian. They'll have to take them in relays, but they should be able to handle it. The rest of us will proceed into the caverns. I'll report in as soon as I have something else meaningful to say.
Good boy, she soothed. Was that so hard? Trust me, we know what we're doing, and we're doing a lot of damage, she added proudly.
Azar is like a kid at Yule, and Telemann is eliminating enemy positions like a conqueror.
Casualties.
Don't worry about that until you return, Pentandra urged. It will just distract you.
She was right. Again. Shit.
All right. Tell everyone I wished them Ifnir's blessing. I opened my eyes and blinked. All right. New plan, I announced.
Why would anyone think they could attack the Vandal? I asked Lelastian, as Sandy and Mavone started taking the naked prisoners through the ways. Do they misunderstand their power?
Misunderstand? She asked, a little dazed. No, they understand it completely. The Enshadowed and their forebears have always resented the power and control the Seafolk have over Kalador. When our ancestors first came here, the more extreme factions interpreted the agreement with them as absolute. The Vandal would control the seas and, with a few notable exceptions, the Alon would rule the land. It was pure arrogance on their part. Most of us were happy to settle for the bounty we were given, and grateful for the opportunity to repair these tortured lands, she sighed. But the fanatics were convinced of their traditional sovereignty. When conflicts arose between the races, as they inevitably do, more reasonable heads have prevailed in council. That's why the Enshadowed were exiled here from more civilized realms, to begin with. But they hate the Vandal as much as they hate the councils.
But they can't hope to succeed in attacking them, I frowned.
They don't need to succeed, she stressed, though I suspect they have the means to cause great destruction for our hosts. Korbal's goal is clear in that sigil. He means to conquer this realm, defend it against the Vandal, and use it as a springboard to conquer the rest of Kalador.
Even the united strength of all the Alkan realms would be insufficient to contest with the Sea Folk, if what I've learned is true, I said worriedly. She nodded, her face just as stricken.
Indeed, yet he feels he has the means to try. If my suspicions are correct, he plays an even more dangerous game than we could have imagined.
I heaved a deep sigh. Lelastian was the only Alkan to ever give me a straight answer when I asked. That made it even more frustrating when she lapsed into obscure language. Then let's keep exploring. You keep ferrying the prisoners back to Timberwatch with the others, and I'll take the rest down to the Undercaverns. When you're ready, you can join us through my waystone.
Menelan, we don't have any idea what's down there, she protested.
It's stairs, I pointed out. I think I can manage to travel down them.
It's what's at the bottom that concerns me, she said.
And you're worried I'll contend with it without Alkan supervision? I'll have Aretas with me, I reminded her. He knows the way.
You do realize he's nearly suicidal, she asked in a whisper.
He is? Why didn't anyone tell me these things?
He's walking through the ruins of a home he's enjoyed for over 1,000 years, she reminded me. The foulest of folk have slithered into it and made it a refuge of evil and destruction. One of the most sacred and unique elements of Anthatiel is being used by an abomination to pollute the land he loves. His only daughter is married to a mortal and will bear him mongrel grandchildren in exile from his ruined legacy. His pride won't let him take his own life, but it will allow him to die heroically in a hopeless quest.
And that's my guide, I asked. My heart falling. She nodded gravely.
Watch him, Menelan. I don't think he's planning on coming back from down there.
That was a depressing thought. I will, I nodded. Anything in particular I should be wary of? I'm not really an expert in Alkan psychology.
It's mostly just like human psychology, only more complex and subtle. Trust me, when the time comes, Eretas will put himself in mortal danger on purpose. So, watch him.
She turned to begin escorting the next few humans through the ways to Timberwatch and safety. I turned toward the doorway that led into the underworld and unknown danger. I nearly ran into Hans.
That was disturbing news,
he murmured. You heard? I asked automatically.
Of course I heard, he said with a small shrug. I'm good at that sort of thing.
I hope you are good at discretion as well. I suggested.
I appreciate the precarious nature of the situation regarding our friend, he said,
nodding slightly toward Eretas, who was peering down the stairwell.
I would hesitate to do anything to inflame it. Are you certain you'll be all right, just the five of you? Asked Mavone, skeptically. I think we'll manage, I agreed, but I enjoy your company. Return them to safety and get back here quickly. Yes, Captain, he nodded. Keep your guard up. Are we finally ready? Asked Asghuri impatiently, as he fiddled with his beard. I'm growing old here. Yes, we are, Master Hans, if you will do us the honor of leading the way. Of course, the Master Thief said, disappearing into the darkened stairwell, his black cloak fading into shadow. Sayake hefted his warhammer, slung his shield, and followed bravely behind him. Eritas, Asghuri, and lastly myself began the long descent into the undercaverns. I don't know how long it took for us to climb down the first several hundred steps, but it quickly became a mental exercise to compel my boots to keep going down. It was different than marching, for some reason. The air became thick and oppressive. Every step I took seemed to draw me closer and closer to something, some nameless fear. It didn't help that the staircase seemed to go on forever. We paused at the first landing to get our bearings, and then continued another long flight that opened up into a chamber about the size of Sevendor Castle's Great Hall. I was surprised to see Eritas stop and regard a shrine? Altar? I still don't know enough about the Alka-Alon to understand, but he touched the collection of objects arranged artfully on a cavern alcove in such a way as to make me think of reverence. Along one wall there was a wide basin, about 4 or 5 feet high, filled with water. I almost paused for a drink when the smell hit me. It's lake water, Eritas explained. When we cut the original shaft, we had to get through the water table. My father had this section built to keep the lower regions from flooding. It was once pristine enough to drink, he said, regretfully gazing into the polluted pool. So this is the entrance to the Chamber of Ages? Asghuri asked, as he peered down the next long flight of stairs. It was one of three doors beside the way we entered. Yes, which is why we should avoid that direct route, Eritas counseled. If Korbal seeks to guard the place from such intrusions as this, that would be the most obvious path to ward. I summoned my thaumaturgical baculus and studied the arcane emanations from that route. It was difficult this far away, but the robust power of the megalith greatly assisted the effort. Yes. He has a few wardings, I would guess, I said. Nothing we can't contend with, I'm certain. I wasn't, but now was a hell of a time to start voicing my doubts. Thankfully, I know another way, Lord Eritas said smugly. The left-hand doorway will lead us down into a secondary chamber. My father's laboratory was there once. That was where he plumbed the deep mysteries of the Ghost Rock. If we can make it there, it offers a means of access to the main vein without contending with any defenses. That sounds like an ideal place for Korbal to use as a headquarters, Asghuri said doubtfully. If he knows it is there, corrected Eritas. When my father went into the realms of light, in my grief I had the place sealed over. Few even know of its existence. If we can make it to that point, we should be able to consider our final task nearly complete, and it is unlikely Korbal warded that route. It has been little used for centuries, save to check the safeguards keeping the lake water out of the caverns.
I do love a back entrance, nodded Hans. It simplifies things. I am more concerned that we have met so little resistance thus far, Sayake said apprehensively. If you were a guard, would you want to have to walk down all those stairs to get here? Asked Asghuri. As the complex above is incomplete, as are the necromantic facilities Korbal is building, I would guess that Korbal sees little value in squandering what manpower he has on guarding a damp old cavern that only he and his necromantic cult have an interest in. Especially since we have yet to encounter the things that our prisoners told us of, I agreed. Could it be that's what is behind the third door? It was once a chamber of reflection, Eritas informed us, a place where one could settle your mind before continuing down to face your ancestors. That's what you were doing down here? Asghuri asked skeptically. Most of us, agreed the Alkan Lord. My father long ago contrived a way to call forth specific enneagrams from within the matrix of the vein, and temporarily installed them in a mechanism that would allow some limited reanimation of their spirits. Enough for brief conversations, at least.
So you were dabbling in necromancy, I said, amused.
Not in the way you humani think of the practice,
Aretas said, making a face. We merely wish to be able to commune with the essence of our loved ones, not create horrors and arcane curiosities. We largely eschewed the deeper areas of the vein, the places that interest you so. We wished to honorably use such a powerful resource, not exploit it for our own gain.
I suppose it's a matter of perspective, I conceded.
Speaking of perspective, Master Ashguri said, studying the fetid pool that I'm sure was once quite lovely, I think I have an idea, he said, and explained himself. Aretas immediately jumped on the details, and the two argued back and forth over them for nearly 10 minutes. I added my own perspective and gave some helpful suggestions. But it was a good idea, and I approved. Ashguri got to work. Hans and Kay, meanwhile, were more concerned with the third door, the one that led to the former meditation chamber.
I'm thinking there are horrors behind that door,
Hans considered, studying its elegant but thoroughly fortified design. It's just the sort of door that conceals horrors.
Does that thought stay your courage, my lord?
Kay asked. It wasn't meant as a dig, I could tell. It was merely his chivalrous response to the situation. He was looking for an opportunity to inspire someone. I'm certain he had a pithy proverb or motivational tale at the ready. Courage isn't the issue, I said, thoughtfully regarding the door.
I'm just wondering what further horrors my mind can manage without going mad, I said, and pushed it open.
Part 3. The Battle of Olum Seheri. Chapter 31. Assault on the Tower of Despair. Tyndall.
Eshe's tits,
Tyndall said, as he stepped through the ways into the burning tower.
How high up are we?
The view below was cataclysmic, a hellish chaos of fire and pain, smoke and suffering, anger and ashes. The flames were climbing incessantly up the front of the Tower of Despair as they consumed the wooden structure within, and a massive pall of putrid smoke mixed with the thick hot air that stung his face and challenged his lungs. He could barely hear the fighting on the street, 7 stories below, though he could not see it beyond the thick wall of flames. Worse, there were cages and gibbets hanging from the corners and face of the building, and those unfortunate souls, both human and Gavanni, screamed in terror as their iron bars heated up and their lungs filled with smoke. They screamed in desperate agony as, one by one, they succumbed to the flames. But as bad as the stench of burnt air, oily smoke and living flesh burning below was, it was the great height that commanded his attention. He'd rarely been this far above the ground before, and never so suddenly. His head spun crazily as the flames under the ledge he found himself on seemed to spin.
9 stories, give or take,
Utterpal said casually, as he hung over the firestorm by one arm and one leg. I didn't pick you for one to be scared of heights, he observed thoughtfully, as Tyndall's hand scrambled to grab the iron bracket nearby.
Not scared, Tyndall insisted, not of heights, or even of falling. It's the inevitable conclusion of the experience that concerns me.
It's usually graciously brief, if that's a help.
It is,
Tyndall agreed, nodding nervously. He'd been in tall places before, like the rooftops of Inarian Academy or the battlements of Sevendor, but in each case he'd arrived at the height by his own power, not suddenly propelled by magic. And he'd been far from the edge, not staring down between his feet into a hellish blaze.
Could you not have chosen a more convenient spot?
This was convenient, Utterpal countered, pointing upward with one gloved finger.
We're but 2 stories below Princess Radin's chamber. It's directly above. This way we can get to her without all that mucking around avoiding guards in the corridors.
I hope you don't expect his grace to go this route, Tyndall said, grasping his iron strut tightly.
As gentleman of the court, I hope you see that would be beneath his dignity.
And if he dies, there's no one around to reward us for this, nodded Utterpal. Quite right. That's why Sir Rondal and Nothua have gone through this entryway, he said, nodding toward a narrow arrow slit in the side of the fortress.
They will clear the way, and once they locate the cell door, they will bring His Grace through the ways to effect a rescue.
It's just like him to take the easy way, Tyndall said with a frown, as he stared up at the long vertical pathway above him.
It was only 35, 40 feet, he reasoned. 35 or 40 long, treacherous, painful feet, in full armor. He stared back down at the flames below. They were 50 feet away now. They were rising with an alacrity he just didn't feel. 40 feet suddenly didn't seem too far to climb. He closed his eyes and summoned a few spells from his stone. The smooth sphere of Irionite in the golden cage around his neck obeyed, and suddenly his vertigo receded. His gloved hands now also adhered to the side of the building, requiring great effort to lift clear of the wall.
All right, I'm ready to go, he announced. Shall I lead, or do you want to?
I'm less likely to fall on top of you than you are me, Utterpal pointed out. He reached out his long arms and pulled himself easily to the next stone ledge. Thankfully, the Gavani sloppy masonry provided a plentitude of such holds. And I do know the way. I peeked in her window to ensure it was truly hers. Tyndall was startled.
You saw her?
Yes, and what a wretchedly regal woman she is, he snorted. She's scrawny, but still hale. It doesn't appear that she's been tortured yet. Utterpal leaped from one perch to another without any visible concern for gravity, entirely resembling the cat that was his namesake. Tyndall nodded as he began to follow the shadow thief. He supposed he climbed as well as his own war namesake, a haystack.
That's good to know,
he gasped, as he made the next difficult ascent to a ledge no wider than his pecker.
I would hate for us to rescue Radin and not have her in a mood to berate us about it.
Is she really that difficult? Utterpal asked, as he made the next leap.
She's highly placed in an organization of murderous, beautiful assassins, Tyndall pointed out. Her charm is merely an affectation for court appearances. Personally, she's vicious, in ways that would make a rat shudder, he added.
The Brotherhood of the Rat, during its heights, was known for its brutality, even among other criminal gangs. But from what Tyndall had learned about the Castoli Ducal Court's family, the thugs could take lessons from Queen Grendine in ruthlessness.
So glad to be rescuing her, then,
Utterpal commented as he patiently assisted Tyndall to the next level.
It just occurred to me,
Tyndall said, both grateful and resentful of the arm the white-haired youth offered him.
If you went all the way up, why didn't you secure a rope from there? In fact, why did you descend 40 feet just to summon me?
Well, there was the matter of this next fellow, the thief said conversationally, as he settled to sit on an impossibly narrow protrusion.
His cell is directly below Radin's, and I don't think I could trust him to not molest such a convenience.
He indicated the bars securing the window to the cell above.
Who is it?
Tyndall asked, thankful of the opportunity to rest. His arms already ached.
I don't know, but he's a grumpy fellow,
the cat assured. He tried to attack me through the bars when I came by. I had to kick him in the face.
Did you try to speak with him?
I was too busy trying to kick him in the face to introduce myself, Utterpal admitted.
I'm sure he was just startled, Tyndall reasoned.
Can we avoid him going up?
To the left,
Utterpal agreed, nodding toward a bracket, holding a small iron gibbet by a thick iron chain. There was a rotting corpse of an alkan within, half devoured through the bars by wyverns. But it did not offer adequate support, and if Tyndall stretched, he could make it to the ledge outside Radin's cell window without passing by the window below. With a final deep breath, Tyndall made the leap, and would have plummeted to his doom in the fire and chaos below had his gloves not been enchanted. He scrambled to gain the top of the bracket before attempting the stretch, but finally he was on the level outside of Radin's cell. The bars were heavy cast iron, he noted, welded into an iron frame that was mortared into the stones of the wall. He grinned and summoned more power from his stone. In seconds, the thick iron turned red as every atomi of the bars oxidized. With the tap of his war wand, the bars crumbled. He took his time to remove as much of the obstruction as possible before he pushed his way through. The cell was dark and narrow, but he could make out the shape standing near the thick wooden door without mage sight. She was a sight. She'd lost weight during her captivity, and her face was drawn and pale under her hair. Where her ringlets had once been sprightly under her maid's careful attendance, now her hair was limp, dirty, and tangled. She was clad in a simple hempen shift without belt or mantle, and she was barefoot. The girl before him only barely resembled the princess he knew, but there was no mistaking the fire in her eyes. "Princess Radin," he announced. "I believe we've been introduced. Sir Tyndall of Sevendor," he said, adding a deep, courtly bow. The girl regarded him suspiciously, but calmly.
"How do I know you are who you say? And not another foul trick to deceive me?" she asked warily. "Because I slew Hammond, my master's servant and your slave, at Timberwatch, the day after Duke Lengwin's death, and only 3 people alive know that,"
Tyndall replied evenly. Radin's eyes shifted back and forth. Easily, the only other witness to the event besides the spellmonger, was slain by his master's wife last year.
"Very well,"
the princess decided.
"So you are, Sir Tyndall. So the spellmonger is here to rescue me?"
she asked skeptically. "He was, alas, otherwise detained," Tyndall said apologetically. He began to search for some spells he hadn't anticipated needing, but decided were in order. First, a mage light, to illuminate the dank cell and give the princess a tangible sign of hope. He almost regretted doing so. Though he disliked Radin personally, she'd been a fair maid. Imprisonment had not been kind to her.
"So, you are rescuing me on your own initiative?" she asked. "Did Mother send you?"
"Nay, Your Highness, this is not a royally sanctioned rescue, I'm afraid," he said, as he pulled his camping equipment out of a Hoxter pocket he'd embedded in a ring on his pinky. "And I am not, technically speaking, here to rescue you. I am here to prepare you to be rescued," he said, opening the field pack that suddenly appeared in the narrow cell. In short order, he removed a tunic, hose, and a cloak, and handed it to the prisoner. Unfortunately, his extra boots were far too large to fit Radin's dainty feet. Radin took the clothes and began dressing at once, without modesty. Nor did she cease her discussion while she tossed aside the rags and pulled the woolen tunic over her head.
"Who, then, is responsible? Did my brother send you?"
"Nay. His Highness prepares to assault an Outremar with a mighty armada to avenge the indignity to the royal house, but he was unwilling to consider a more direct approach." Tyndall grabbed the few more things he thought she might need from his pack before sending it back to its hoxter. "Your father offered rewards, but little else, as he is being restrained in the matter by other forces. Though, by all accounts, he's plunged into melancholy over your capture," he added sympathetically.
"Wine?"
he asked, holding out a skin of cheap Castali Red to her, as she poured the cloak over her shoulders. Radin nearly leapt at the skin and poured several swallows into her thirsty mouth before she reluctantly lowered it and wiped her lips.
"They've given me naught but filthy water to drink," she admitted.
"Father did nothing, with Mother screaming at him constantly."
Tyndall cleared his throat. He didn't want to answer that question. Radin sensed his reluctance. Her imprisonment had in no way reduced her awareness of such subtleties.
"The truth, Sir Tyndall, buys you my friendship such as it is," she offered. "The unvarnished truth.
Queen Grindine was more than reluctant to send rescue," Tyndall finally admitted. "She considered your captivity to be a tidy answer to a manifold of problems. What to do with a daughter difficult to marry off? Removing a possible threat to Tavard and his family as he inherits the throne, and an excuse for her son to indulge in vainglorious conquest. And your dear sister-in-law, by all accounts, finds herself more at ease with you lodged so far from court."
Sorry, Your Highness, but that is the unvarnished truth.
The Queen was almost pleased at the development." Tyndall watched helplessly as Radin's thin face contorted in a storm of raw emotions. He watched as a daughter lost faith in her parents, a sister in her brother, and a loyal servant in her demanding mistress. Then something else settled into her expression, and a new tint came to her eye. It was a cold, unyielding expression, the kind one feared in a foe and made one fret when seen in a friend.
"Was she?"
Radin finally said when she regained her composure.
"How interesting. So, whom do I thank for this rescue attempt? The Magi at large?
Nay, Your Highness,
Not everyone in your family sees but their own concerns. Your cousin Anguin arranged this rescue, and it was no common feat, he added.
Anguin? Really?
She asked in disbelief. His Grace felt his honour touched that brigands would contemplate such an affront on the royal house in his realm. His circumstances have made him quite devoted to his duties as head of his family, he said tactfully. He risked what treasury he had and what allies he could muster in the attempt.
But why would Anguin? What could...
It's no matter, she decided. He's earned my undying gratitude just for making the attempt.
As have you all, she added.
Atipald chose that moment to stick his head through the rusted bars.
Tyndall, has His Grace arrived? Because there's something crawling up the side of the tower now, through the flames,
he emphasized worriedly.
Not yet, but I expect him any moment,
Tyndall answered.
Your Highness, might I present Sir Atipald the Cat of an Ultramar, a mage knight of the Astarsi Order?
Sir Atipald, my thanks for your efforts on my behalf,
Radin said quickly, as she took stock of the situation.
How many of you are there? I heard some ruckus earlier, then saw the tower catch fire.
His Grace has enlisted hundreds, perhaps thousands, in the effort to rescue you, Your Highness, Tyndall assured. There are two teams of war magi assaulting the island as we speak, and dozens of brave wilderlords. Terra Adon and Kasari Rangers are causing havoc to distract the defenders from this rescue. He hoped that made her feel important for some reason.
But Anguin doesn't have the resources. I heard his palace was burnt.
Attacked by a dragon, alas. Tyndall agreed. That was a rough night. I had to kill the damn thing myself.
Oh, not this again,
snorted Atipal. Ishi's tits, will you stop bragging for one moment and remember that there are things crawling up the side of the building toward us through the fire? Tyndall sighed.
Fine, fine. Let me contend with that, he said, and closed his eyes.
Pentandra?
He sent mind to mind. It took a moment for the court wizard of Alshar to respond to him, but she soon replied.
What is it, Tyndall?
We have the princess in hand, he reported. She is safe, reasonably healthy, and uninjured. She's also extremely pissed, he added. He knew Pentandra would want to know.
Anguin and Rondol haven't shown up yet, but I got her dressed and gave her some wine. I don't have any shoes for her, though. Any way you could scare up some slippers or something? She'll need them when she comes through.
I'll have some sent to the Waystone,
she promised. Minalan has entered Korbal's temple complex, she reported without being asked.
Azar is thundering across the island. Terlaman is making impressive gains. Casualties are still light.
Thanks, Pentandra. Oh, and is there any way you could convince Daura to send a few hawks over here? Atipal thinks something is scaling the tower behind us. If they could do anything about that, it would keep us from being rushed.
I'll see what I can do, she pledged.
Good luck.
Help is on the way, he promised Atipal. In the meantime, drop something on them.
Now, what else do you require, Your Highness, before you're rescued?
A sword,
she said instantly.
I've wished for nothing else more devoutly, even rescue, for weeks. Give me a blade. I swear by Trigg's grace and Duin's strength I will never feel helpless again,
she vowed. Thankfully, Tyndall could assist her with that. He collected such wares on his adventures, and had a hoxter with a small selection of unenchanted but extremely well-made swords. It helped him in swordplay to be familiar with swords of different sizes and configurations. He thoughtfully selected a leaf-shaped infantryman's blade, elegant and deadly, a style favoured in the late Majocracy in the East. It appeared at his command, and he presented it to the princess with some small ceremony.
Thank you, Sir Tyndall,
she breathed as she wrapped her skinny fingers around the hilt and lifted the blade. It seemed overlarge in her hands, but she handled it in a way that told him she knew how to use it.
Now I have hope. Where is that cousin of mine?
As if summoned, there was a knock at the cell door.
Your Highness,
came Sir Gideon's voice through the small iron grate.
Are you within?
I am, and I'm ready to be elsewhere,
Radin reported flatly. In a few moments, the iron lock that secured the door was shattered, as if frozen, and the door creaked open. Anguin strode in to the tiny cell with as much bravado as he could under the circumstances. He executed a short bow.
Your Highness, are you ready to depart?
He asked, only to receive an entirely unanticipated embrace.
Yes, get me the hells out of here,
she hissed into his ear.
Now!
Anguin looked entirely uncomfortable with the situation, but he returned the embrace while he looked around frantically for support.
"I'll take them back,"
Atapal said, sliding through the window. "My father insisted I see him safely home, and I do not like the look of those things below." Rondal poked his head up from behind Sir Gideon's mailed shoulder.
"I'll assist,"
he offered. "I've got a few more prisoners here in need of rescue. We've spellbound the doors to the lower levels, which will require some time for the guards to get through, but it won't hold them for long," he warned.
"Then let's get you back home,"
Tyndall said, stepping out of the way while Atapal and Rondal escorted the nobles through the ways. When they were gone, he was left alone with Lady Nothwa. She didn't look particularly ladylike in her war armor, but Tyndall didn't mind her hiding her femininity. She was an excellent war mage and a doughty fighter in mundane terms. She carried a battlestaff configured as a spear, he saw, and the expression under her helmet was set in a fell grimace.
"So that was it?"
she demanded. "All that build-up to rescue a princess and...
that was it?
Would you prefer trying to fight your way out of the tower, through the ruined city transformed into a war zone, through the fetid lake and past the dragons, only to escort her over 1,000 miles of treacherous territory back home?"
"Yes, actually,"
Nothua said, blinking. Tyndall stopped short at that.
"I guess I'm glad you weren't in charge of planning then,"
he decided.
"Do you want to look at some of these other prisoners?"
she asked impatiently. "Or do you want to reflect on strategic matters?"
"Let's search,"
he decided. The interior of the Tower of Despair was even more depressing than the exterior, thanks to Gavani-sized doors and corridors that only rarely opened up properly. Tyndall found that there were 12 cells lining the exterior of the floor, and 7 interior cells that lacked even the luxury of a barred window to the outside. Tyndall wondered whether that was a blessing or a punishment, however. The damp climate of the island had encouraged mildew and mold to grow on every solid surface. Though newly constructed, the structure of the building was already starting to demonstrate wear, and as they wound their way down the corridor to take inventory of the remaining prisoners, they chanced across several repaired sections. In other places, prisoners had expressed their ire by throwing their crude clay chamber pots into the corridor where they had been left. At least one inhabitant had died, and their decomposing body filled the floor with the stench. Tyndall sought to check the identity of each prisoner through the bars before freeing them. Nothua was content to wreck their cell door and move on without comment. In short order, the freed prisoners began filling the halls of the floor. They were an eclectic lot, including a few courtiers who'd been captured with Her Highness, some Wilderlords imprisoned for the temerity of defending their lands, and some southern folk, whose captivity didn't seem to make much sense to him at all.
"We're hostages,"
a young woman from an ultramar explained when he helped her from her cell.
"I'm Lady Anisha of Surya, and my father is a baron. He resisted the efforts of the council at Phallus, so I was abducted from the temple I was studying in and brought here to persuade him."
"Why not just kill him?" he blurted out. Perhaps not the best response to a girl who was once comely, but Tyndall's mouth seemed enchanted to say such things.
"Because the council is already having trouble maintaining power among the nobles, and such a thing would only worsen the rising murmurs against the Count of Reims,"
Anisha explained.
"That makes sense,"
Nothua nodded, as she helped another man out of his dingy inner cell.
"Probably took the youngest children, not the oldest, the ones whose deaths would be more emotionally devastating. That's what I would do,"
she decided. Tyndall suppressed a shudder at her coldness.
"Let us rescue as many of you as possible, then,"
he said, as confidently as he could manage. "Each one is a victory over their plans." Put strategically, he doubted Nothua could object. He knew better than to attempt to invoke her sense of humanity. The war mage, formerly known as Lady Mask, had little from what he had observed.
"Are there any other prisoners of note in the tower that you are aware of?"
she asked the Alshari noblewoman.
"They had me on the floor below this one last week,"
she offered, searching her memory.
"I recall a few other Alshari hostages, and some Castali officials."
"That's enough for me," Tyndall agreed. "As soon as Rondal and Atapal get back, we can start bringing you folks back to civilization and safety," he promised. They'd freed everyone they could on the floor when the 2 Magi sought permission to come through the waystone he carried in the hilt of his mage blade. Rondal brought reinforcements of a sort, 2 Terra Alon warriors who could take several folk through the ways at once to speed their rescue.
This is going to take a while, even with the help, he noted to his friend as the first wave departed. Cantandra says to save as many as we can, Rondal suggested. Have you found the Dredrian captive yet? No, and my little fellows will be vexed with me if I don't, Tyndall said, shaking his head. I thought for certain that he would be here somewhere. All right, keep searching, Rondal commanded. I'll take the next lot back. You keep the place secure. It's a prison, Tyndall pointed out. It was already secure before we got here. As soon as he was certain all four parties had left, reducing the number of captives by more than half, he continued to question the emaciated Lady Anisha, giving the half-starved woman a dried sausage and a swig from his wineskin after passing around a water bottle to those who needed it. We haven't been here as long as the others, she told him between anxious bites. I hesitate to say, but we're the fortunate ones. Anyone who made any serious noise was sent below, she said, nodding toward a window. There were work gangs in need of bodies, she reported. It was deadly work and brutal. We were told that they didn't much care if the bodies were alive or dead. The dead don't eat as much, they joked. They weren't joking, I'm afraid, Tyndall said with a sigh, and I think you would have joined them once your purpose had been fulfilled. As Shadul has designs on the Wilderlands, Korbal seeks to undermine the South. He's infiltrated the Rebel Council, he told her. His minions are planning out every move the Count of Reims and his colleagues make now. That would explain much, she sighed. There have been many policies from the Council that made no sense, without that context. Oh, Father will be angry when he learns of this. Who do we have to thank for our rescue? She asked, as Rondal reappeared nearby. Why, your own good Duke Anguin, who arranged this entire rescue, Tyndall reported. The one which the Rebel Council deems a captive in his own lands. Does this look like an operation designed by a man fettered by conquest, my lady? He asked, when Atapal returned. No, Sir Tyndall, it does not, agreed the scrawny noblewoman, as she took Atapal's hand for the transport. It seems the righteous wrath of a powerful lord, she said, as a loud boom shook the building. Farewell, and I hope we meet again, she said, as the spell took her away. Can't you go anywhere without flirting with the locals? Nothua asked, irritated, when they were alone again. No, not really, admitted Tyndall. Besides, it was good relations for his grace. When Anisha is returned to her kin, she'll bear the tale of who was responsible. That will help build support for his claim, he reasoned. In a decade or so, when he's built up enough strength to challenge the rebels, she might be married to someone powerful enough to turn the tide of battle or politics. So you don't merely flirt, you scheme, she snorted disapprovingly. What do you think that boom was? Spellcraft, he said, shrugging. Whether ours or theirs, and of what nature, I cannot say, nor do I think it matters. We have at least one more floor to examine before we can leave, and those Gavanni will find a way around the spellbinding eventually. Nothua's eyes opened wide, and she grabbed his shoulder as she whirled her spear into a guard position. And then there are the things crawling up the side of the building, she said tersely. One of which is now behind you. Chapter 32 Pentandra. Pentandra heaved a great sigh of relief when she received confirmation that Duke Anguin had arrived at the waypoint outside with Princess Radine, and knew at once she had to go greet them, personally. She used her baculus, Everkeen, as a mere lever for once, and hauled her great bulk out of her comfortable chair. It had ceased being comfortable an hour ago, but she was beyond the point where she could be comfortable in any position, sitting, standing, or lying down.
Allura, a hand?
She asked, when her efforts weren't enough. She'd be damned if she'd use magic to get around, yet. Not when she had a perfectly good apprentice at hand. The blind girl groaned in annoyance, but held out her hand without turning her head. Her raven, Lucky, was keeping her informed of where everyone was in the room around her through the semi-permanent link they'd formed, but that didn't keep her from normal teenaged frustration, nor had frequent lectures on social propriety. Pentandra pointlessly rolled her own eyes and took the hand, leaning into both her apprentice and her baculus, to haul her ass out of the chair.
This, she muttered darkly under her breath, is ridiculous. We have the princess,
she announced in a louder voice to her monitors, the wizards and clerks keeping track of each group. There was a ragged cheer and a visible expression of relief from the Ashari courtiers who'd witnessed the tense expedition.
His grace accompanies her and all are safe and sound.
That wasn't exactly accurate, considering how many brave men and women were still in the field, but it was enough to purchase another cheer. She began the long trek down the steps of the makeshift dais and out of the blue barn into the staging area for the mission. It was tortuous. Her feet hurt. She had to pee. Her back ached with a special urgency. Number two was being fussy, keeping her sisters awake, Pentandra noted with irritation, and number one was responding defiantly. She could sense each of the triplets' personalities now. Number one was a fighter. Number two was the sensitive one. And number three was the troublemaker. She didn't view such predictions as prophecy as much as observation. Having three other people actually inside your body gave you incredible insight into their personalities, without the benefit of magic or even conversation. Sometimes it was like a pile of kittens in there, other times it was like an overcrowded tavern. Pentandra never expected to appreciate the proximity of her children, as much as she did, but she'd come to enjoy the process of gestation despite the severe discomfort and inconvenience it caused. The priestesses called it Trig's maternal grace, the special divine patience a woman cultivated as she brought forth new life into the world. It was considered a holy benefice from the Mother Goddess. It was Pentandra's professional opinion that there was some internal alchemy at play. Thankfully, the girls had settled down when she got up. Pentandra leaned on both Allura and Evakeen as she walked with the stately grace of a woman trying desperately not to stumble. The weather of the morning was starting to turn, and she could feel a few sprinkles of rain from the overcast sky on her face. The mage cobbled square was far more vacant now, with only the reserves gathered in force at their station. Even the Skyriders were deployed now in support of the operation. Pentandra did her best to hurry over to the third waystone, where the first rescued prisoners were being escorted away by the Alshari knights at hand.
Your Highness,
she said breathlessly. Number three was stabbing her diaphragm most painfully.
Your Grace, are you well?
She asked, concerned.
I live, stand, walk, and can hold a sword, Princess Radin assured her, displaying some unbloodied blade she'd picked up. I want to thank you all, she said, looking around at the people crowding in to witness her return. When I was imprisoned and bereft of hope, you came to my succor. I shall not forget,
she declared to cheers.
Nor shall I forget the bravery of my dear cousin in daring such a dangerous mission. No one knows the perils of that dark tower more than I.
She looked fondly at Anguin's blushing face.
Thus, no one knows what courage it took to assail it better than I. My most profound thanks and gratitude are yours, eternally.
My lady, I could no more let you languish in captivity than I could my own sisters, he said, with special emphasis. Anguin was starting to understand the value of political theatre. There were enough members of court here witnessing the safe return of Anguin to spread the rumour of his response to Radin's gracious thanks.
Is there some place I could go to wash up, Lady Pentandra?
She asked demurely.
I have a hall prepared, Your Highness, she assured, just a short distance away, though I can summon a carriage if you prefer. I prefer to walk,
she declared defiantly, the sword still in her hand.
For months I have been captive in one form or fashion. I wish to use my legs as a free woman for once. Trig knows I could stand the exercise,
she said proudly, and began following Duke Anguin and his bodyguard toward the hall. Pentandra followed behind, trying to keep up with the stream of congratulations while still being hailed mind to mind from the battle. Thankfully, there was a lull in the fighting. Azar had secured his area without further opposition. Telamon was dug in advance of his retreat position, and Tyndall and Nothawar were rounding up additional prisoners to rescue. She had one terse conversation with Minilan, in which she had to remind him that she was in charge of operations, but he'd been the only issue so far. He was safely inside the Dread Pyramid now, beyond her ability to assist him. By the time she was done with him, they'd arrived at the simple hall. Pentandra watched as Princess Radin's entire manner changed as she entered the hall behind her cousin. Her shoulders slumped, her chin rose,
and her expression turned to a scowl as the door shut behind them.
"Is there something amiss, Highness?"
Pentandra asked, troubled, as the princess issued a tortured groan.
"No, my lady. The entire world is askew,"
Radin said, dropping her borrowed cloak to the floor.
"I've been held captive for months, and my parents, the all-powerful king and queen of Castelshah, can't be bothered to send even one man to rescue me. I have to depend on the unforeseen kindness of my poor cousin for rescue. No, my lady, there is something completely amiss."
"My cousin," began Anguin thoughtfully, "I hope that my intervention didn't." His hesitant words seemed to enrage Radin, though. She snapped viciously, though her ire was not directed at him.
"You did nothing wrong, Anguin,"
she declared. "I was not facetious in offering my thanks and my gratitude so publicly. I have been betrayed by my closest kin, resigned to an enemy prison to further the schemes of my mother and brother, and that bitch he married. Lady Pentandra, your understanding of court matters is well known. What say you? What meaning can I draw from my family's inattention?"
"Well,
your brother did begin an invasion of an Ultramar," she offered hesitantly, "and your father offered 2 vacant baronies in Gilmora for your return."
"2 baronies? I should have more in my dowry," she scoffed. "And Tavard was going to engage the rebels anyway. He's been planning it since they rebelled. He wants to conquer an Ultramar for himself."
"An Ultramar is mine," Anguin insisted. "He gets none of it."
"Relax,"
Pentandra insisted, indulging in the informal for the sake of brevity. She had a battle to get back to. "He's going to get shredded at sea. Everyone knows it, but he and the fools in his court backing the measure.
May I examine you, Highness, just to ensure nothing serious is amiss, physically?"
she added. Radin nodded and spread her arms, as Pentandra peered at her with Everkeen's insights. The Baculus obediently reached out and probed Radin's thin frame from arcane shroud to her core enneagram. The princess saved her invective for her family, not her erstwhile physician.
"It would serve the idiot right, and my mother for supporting such nonsense. I saw the defences an Ultramar has from the deck of a slave ship, and they let me languish in support of that."
"I believe his plan concerns seizing large portions of the coastline and then demanding your return," Anguin said with a snort.
"So, I'm merely a pretext for a conquest,"
Radin said angrily.
"That's even worse. In your opinion, Lady Pentandra, what does my family's response to my captivity indicate about their motivations? Candor, please,"
she directed. Pentandra looked up from the reading she was taking through her enchanted rod. She struggled to find some way to equivocate, but it was against her nature, and she felt the girl deserved the truth.
"They have abandoned you, Highness," she admitted. "I'm sorry."
"Don't be," Radin said.
"Pity them instead. Did they not realize how much danger they were in for having me in the open? I revealed nothing, nor did those beasts know to ask. But if they had, I might have been tempted to relent, especially if I'd known they were sending no help. They abandoned me? They dared abandon me? The finest jewel in the castle, and they let it be stolen like yesterday's bread,"
she fumed. "I offer you refuge for as long as you require, before you return home, cousin," pledged Anguin. "I don't have much in the way of grand estates to offer, but what I have is at your disposal."
"Thank you, Anguin,"
she said with a sigh. "Of all people to offer me kindness, yours is most unexpected, and therefore the most appreciated. Allow me some time to clean, eat, and rest, and I promise I will inform and advise you in a better humor."
"You are as well as can be expected,"
Pentandra pronounced. "Everkeen tells me you need to slake your thirst and eat well for a few days, but some sleep and rest should restore you completely."
"Take the time you need,"
Anguin nodded graciously. "I'm afraid I have to return to service. As important as this operation is, we conducted a massive raid to act as a distraction, and I still have troops in the field to oversee. Summon me at need."
"Thank you, all,"
the emaciated princess sighed. "I had nearly given up hope of a real bed or a hot meal again, let alone freedom and safety."
"I will repay your kindness,"
she insisted.
It is repayment enough that you are well, my cousin. Anguin bowed and gestured for Pentandra to follow him. What do you make of that? He asked, as the door shut behind them. Sir Gideon kept step with them, but walked behind them deferentially.
Was that really Radin? What did they do to her? She was almost nice,
Anguin blurted. They didn't do anything to her, beyond confining her in chains and in a cell, Your Grace. Pentandra assured him. She holds no taint of blue magic, necromancy, or any other glamour that Everkeen could see. It could be that her time in seclusion was an opportunity for self-reflection. But there is no doubt it wrought a change in her, she said, glancing over her shoulder at the hall.
I would more likely credit sorcery as introspection,
mused Anguin. I know how to contend with a spiteful, hateful Radin. I'm not certain I can deal with a grateful and respectful one.
Give her a few days, Pentandra ventured. I think that with a few days' sleep and some decent food, we'll see much of the old Radin return. Her ire is certainly intact, she observed.
And for once not aimed at me, Anguin agreed, relieved. I really do have to get back to my command post now that this is done, he continued, placing his helmet on his head. The Iron Band has reported much activity in the garrisons throughout the Penumbra. Likely I have another invasion on my hands.
I'll tend to the princess in the meantime,
Pentandra assured her liege. They both looked back at the hall, which seemed quiet. Too quiet. I think I prefer my chances with the Gavani, Anguin decided.
I envy Your Grace the freedom of that choice, Pentandra agreed. See one of the yellow-sashed magi? Those are Carmelis folk. One of them will be happy to see you to wherever you need to go.
Pentandra took her time getting back to her seat in the barn. Had there been any pressing emergency, she would have been summoned. She took the rare opportunity to send her apprentice to fetch something to eat from the kitchens, while she took advantage of a proper privy. By the time she returned to the headquarters in the barn, things had, of course, deteriorated. She settled in that damn uncomfortable, comfortable chair and sighed, feeling somewhat refreshed and relieved.
Report,
she announced to her subordinates as they moved from one station to another around her. She was gratified. The news could be worse. Azar's brave commandos had secured a wide area on the western end of the island, but they were now spread out and had lost sight of each other in the maze of ruins. A few were being subjected to attacks by individual Gavani hiding in the rubble. Others swore that there were forces congregating just beyond easy view. For Telamon's part, he'd liberated one large prison complex housing common slave laborers and had his sights set on the other. And Arborn's Kasari, she learned in moments, were skulking their way across Olum Saheri, sticking to the edges of the battles erupting across the island, sniping, setting snares and traps, and gathering an enormous amount of intelligence, while the defenders of the place were otherwise occupied. She checked in directly by mirror with Arborn, who was leading his hand-picked night owls through a largely abandoned section of the ruined city. He was not only hale and unwounded, he seemed to be having far too much fun on the mission for Pentandra's comfort. Dara, at least, seemed to be taking her part of the mission seriously. Her Skyriders had transported in to the second site, the one Terlaman controlled, and transformed their flying steeds from there. Once they were ready, they took flight and provided not just excellent observations, but were able to provide support when either force became bogged down by defenders. The Skyriders were a marvel to behold. 12 giant hawks flew above Olum Saheri, working together and covering each other with the ease of long practice. Pentandra had to give credit to Dara. She'd been given some help in the transgenics from the Alka Alon, but recruiting Skyriders and training had all been her own ambition. The riders were becoming adept at combat operations, particularly the Alshari wing, the one that had helped keep the Wilderlands clean of Gavani spies and raiders for the last few weeks. Now they flew in formation in an endless ring over the island, swooping to attack with hand-hurled thaumaturgic weapons or the deadly skybolts, special javelins designed to be thrown from hawkback with deadly accuracy. In addition, each of the giant birds was now equipped with steel barbs on their talons, and had been trained in how to use the devices with brutal efficiency. Even Minilan's desperate journey under Korbal's evil pyramid was going well, the additional 18 prisoners he'd rescued notwithstanding. Only token resistance to the unexpected incursion told Pentandra that the multiple layers of distraction had been successful.
The island's defenders were so preoccupied with the raids that they left Korbal's most intimate complex virtually unguarded. In fact, things were going so well that she knew they couldn't last. Her limited experience with warfare had demonstrated that no plan went according to plan, once an actual enemy was involved. Thus far, the denizens of Olam Saheri had responded as expected. The Gavani and trolls had reacted to the incursions predictably, and even with the few Nemavorti leading the resistance, there hadn't been much in the way of unusual elements. Azar and Minilin had each taken down one of the undead lords. Having done so once herself, she knew how difficult that was. But she knew it was only a matter of time before the minions of Korbal regrouped, reformed, and counterattacked in force. Exactly how long that would take was a measure of their foe's organization and power. That was the strategic side of this raid, the boring parts that everyone else forgot about, the parts Pentandra knew were almost as important as a princess. She couldn't forget those parts, else all might be lost. All might be lost anyway, she knew. That damn book of prophecies was chewing a hole in her soul. 7 scholars descend into the Chamber of Ages, the handmaiden to fetch. Their only desire, a guardian found, the consort is bound. 1 falls through treachery, leaving 6 sages. From scholarship to war, they soon retire. When she'd first come across the phrase, it was yet another meaningless bit of doggerel old Antime had inflicted on her. She'd taken it at face value, figuring it describing far-off and obscure events, as many of Antime's prophecies did. Then Eritas mentioning the Chamber of Ages had caused it to spring to mind. Minilin's squadron had taken the name of the Scholars, and the rest of the prophecy snapped into context. 1 falls through treachery. That didn't bode well for his team, particularly if he himself was one of those who were stricken. That would doom them all, she was certain. Happily, there were so many other prophecies that mentioned Minilin by name that she didn't worry too much about his survival. But that only brought scant comfort. There would be loss in this raid, she knew for a fact. More than the 7 bodies that already decorated the staging area's ambitious morgue, or the 12 others yet to be brought through the ways. 2 from Minilin's party would be stricken, and there was nothing she could do to avoid that. Nor could she even discuss the matter with anyone. Worse, there were at least 2 or 3 other prophecies that definitely concerned this raid, perhaps more. Most only came into focus with the context of experience, and often then it was too late to do anything about them. Pentandra was starting to appreciate more and more just why the censorate condemned prophets to death. It was a mercy killing. As there was little she could do to affect the outcome of what was prophesied, she did her damnedest to control what wasn't. In rapid succession, she informed Azar about a unit of goblins forming on his north flank, sent a squadron of reinforcements to aid Turlaman's bid to liberate a prison, and ordered Dara's wing to shift their attacks to cover the Tower of Despair, as Rondel had dubbed it. There were things crawling up the sides, the report said, too high for anyone but the Skyriders to contend with. She handled everything she could, pushing the information around to where it would do the most good, and then making suggestions. For example, she suggested that Nothua and Tyndall get the hell out of the tower, but the impetuous boy thought he could free more high-value prisoners if he was given more time, and Rondel was supporting him, insisting on returning to the battlefield, now that the initial prisoners were safely transported through the ways. Pentandra had to concede to that, and then argue with Minilin about it a moment later. He too had more prisoners to send them, while he continued his descent. She forced herself not to focus on the stirrings of prophecy. She knew better than anyone how swiftly it turned in your hand. Best to ignore the implications and focus on the battle, she reasoned. One could go mad otherwise. Pentandra, there's a band of undead congregating away from the battles, one of her observers, a Hessian order mage named Osban, reported. About 60 so far, but more are arriving. Drogon, Nemavorti, or the market variety walking corpse, she asked, hoping for the last. No way to tell, Osban admitted. I'll send a hawk by to take a look, he suggested. She nodded. She hoped the Skyrider was careful. There were all sorts of nasty things the Nemavorti could do. But that's what the flying cavalry was there for, reconnaissance and support. As long as the dragons weren't roused against them, they should be fine. That hadn't happened yet,
But Pentandra knew the two big monsters were Olam Saheri's most devastating defensive weapon. The problem was they were also fiendishly difficult to control, by all accounts. Much like whipping up a windstorm. Once it was loose, it was largely uncontrollable. If Korbal valued his nascent fortress, he'd keep the dragons away. Once they started attacking, they were like puppies with a rat. Little else could distract them until all around them was in ruin. She still remembered with horror the night one of the beasts destroyed her home. Had she not been at a professional meeting, she would likely have died in its attack. As it was, she'd lost dozens of friends in the devastating assault on the palace at Barone. Had the Magi not been nearby, and had it not been for their bravery and ingenuity, the beast would have gone on to slay thousands in the rustic capital. She still had to figure out a way to thank Tyndall properly for that. Rondal she'd taken care of. Her assistance to Gatina was proof of her gratitude. But Tyndall was more difficult. 2 Nemavorti and at least 20 Drogon, by Rider Astol's estimation, Osban reported. Possibly more. He only got a brief look at the crowd before they chased him off. Singed his steed's tail feathers. Any idea of which way they are headed? She asked, glancing at the many maps around her. South or west? Or, goddess forbid, northeast, toward the pyramid. Now that Radin and Anguin were safely back from Olam Saheri, the mission's next priority was to purchase as much time for Menelin and the rest of the scholars to get to the undercaverns. She still had reinforcements to send through the ways, but it was helpful to know in which direction to send them. No telling, Osban said, after a moment's consultation with the rider mind to mind. Astol was one of the few magically talented riders she knew, at least enough to earn a stone. They were in a big square cleared in the midst of several ruined buildings. They could go either way, and a smaller group is banding together to their southwest. They'll likely go after Azar's company, if I read their positioning correctly. Let him know to expect company, Pentandra ordered one of the other monitors. Osban? See if one of those wings can swing around in force and take a good, healthy shit on those restless cadavers. Berserkers' balls don't work on them, he reminded her. The Skyriders have more than that to work with, Pentandra assured him. Believe me, the enchanters of Sevendor loaded them with new weapons to test in battle. Tell Dara's folk to use some of them. The wizard nodded as he went to do her bidding. In a moment it was clear that Osban's prediction about the smaller band was correct. Azar sent 6 war magi and a half dozen wilderlords to intercept them, while he prepared to demolish a building in which a company of Gavani, living and dead, was using as an archery blind against him. The larger group was headed south, however, what was left of them. The second wing reported a successful attack on the group, showering the undead army with chunks of rock the size of bushels from huckster pockets, as well as alchemical fires that clung and burned the painless foe down to their dead bones and stuck to their lifeless fingers when they tried to beat it out. The charred remnants of the company, more than 50 strong, began moving southward after their 2 Nemavorti fought off the attack with magic. Inform Telamon that it's his turn to show some hospitality, she commanded to a clerk. I'll have the next 20 fresh reinforcements sent through to bolster his position, she advised. A quick word with Azar, mind to mind, assured her that he wasn't in need of them first. Before she could open her eyes again, another message came through her arcane link, this time from Mavone, of all people. Penny, something's happened, he reported laconically. We were about to send the reinforcements through before returning for the next batch of prisoners. But it didn't work. What didn't work? The spell that opens the ways, he said calmly. We've all tried, even the Elka Alon. I don't know how he did it, nor do they, but somehow Korbal has severed the ways of Olam Saheri from the outside world, including the waystones we brought with us. We had someone from each team in the field try to get out through the ways. No luck. Korbal has cut them off. I thought that was impossible. So did the Elka Alon, he observed. You should see Unranyan losing his mind over this. It's not supposed to happen, he says. It can't happen. If things weren't suddenly so dire, it would be funny. But until we find a way to counter the effect, we're cut off from supporting our people. Sandoval, Melastian, Unranyan, and I are stuck on this side, as are the reinforcements. Azar, Terlaman, Rondal, Minelin, they're all on their own now. Chapter 33 The Menace Above the Lake Dara.
It was so different, regarding the battle below from the back of a relatively strange bird, Dara reflected, as she coaxed Fearless over the grim beaches of Olam Saheri. With Frightful, she and her bird were nearly one creature, so long had they worked together. But Frightful was tending to her nest now, and so Dara had to take flight on Fearless's broad back instead. He was a magnificent bird, she had to admit, one of the best of the first wing. A Minden's raptor, at home in these very mountains, and one of the largest Mastermin had brought back from his first trip to Verone after the war. The first war, she corrected. She was standing on the vanguard of the second. Phyllis's 36-foot wingspan allowed him to soar with dignified grace, and he was an especially vicious warrior. Most birds had to be coaxed from hunting to fighting, but not Fearless. He'd earned his name by how eagerly he'd leapt into his training. His massive talons were assisted by steel coverings, blades that extended the bird's natural attack with an additional 5 inches of razor-sharp, mage-fired steel. Repeatedly, the massive bird had dived at her command to rip up clawfuls of Gavanni and fling the remains into the gruesome lake. But it still wasn't the same as flying Frightful, she knew. When they were together, they flew as one, without much in the way of commands. She had to fly Fearless more like she rode a horse, which required a lot more of her attention. "We need you to swing back over Turlamund's position, Dara, and see if they're being menaced from the lakeside," requested Darmanal, the wizard in charge of relaying information to her team. She could, and did, speak directly to Pentandra, who had charge of the battle, but she tried not to bother the pregnant wizard without cause. She had enough to keep up with. "On my way," she promised in return. A quick glance confirmed her wingmen were still where they were supposed to be. Tassi and Broal were flying Festive and Fancy, two older, well-trained birds, and the newest rider to the first wing, Ritha, was in tail position with the massive Faithful. "Patrol south!" she shouted into the wind, making the hand gestures that communicated the order at the same time. She did it twice, until her wingmen repeated it back and relayed the information back to Ritha. Satisfied that her wing knew the orders, Dara encouraged Fearless to bank gracefully over the awful waterfront and toward the knot of violence Turlamund was sponsoring on the south bank of the island. From the air, Dara could see the lines of battle clearly, lit by mage lights, torches, and the light of dozens of fires resulting from the assault. Not the least was the giant pyre the evil-looking tower in the center of the city was transforming into. The growing flames cast plenty of flickering shadows, allowing her to pick out the lines of each side. Turlamund and his war magi held a strong forward position, Dara could see. The knight commander had staked out a makeshift redoubt atop a pile of rubble overlooking the southwestern corner of the ruined city, and his men had quickly reformed the debris into a defensive shelter from which they could attack. Two smaller outposts had been similarly carved out in the rubble, each boasting 5 or 6 diminutive warriors who supported Turlamund's main position. A few hundred feet behind them, across a corpse-strewn field of debris that bore testament to the heat of the fighting, the Terra Alon volunteers were busy establishing an even more robust redoubt around the waypoint entrance. A dozen war magi had pushed the perimeter of the attack hundreds of yards in all directions, and she could see, through mage sight, the sweeping fisherman's net of interlocking defensive spells being woven around the site. Beyond the attackers' lines lingered many small